You are Locked On Hawks, your daily Atlanta Hawks podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
Hello, friends, and welcome to episode 511 of the Locked On Hawks podcast. I am your host, Brad Rowland. It is a Wednesday afternoon slash evening here on the East Coast, and my partner in crime today is on the West Coast, so it's early afternoon out there, and joining me as often, it's been a little while though, is the great Jeff Siegel. What's up, man?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm all right. You know, the Hawks have this very sort of weird three-day, full-day break on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday where they don't have games. Only the second and only, I guess, the final time, aside from the All-Star break this year, that they don't play for three straight days. So we're sort of in this weird reset mode, which I kind of appreciate as someone who, you know, grinds often on the team. But they'll be back at home on Saturday. But in the meantime here, the trade deadline's coming. We'll talk a lot about that here in the very near future on this podcast. But one bit of news I wanted to at least start off with, this is very minor in the grand scheme of things, but Tyler Dorsey and Alex Poitras were sent to the G League actually this morning, and kind of amusingly, that announcement came about an hour before tip-off of a matinee game for the BayHawks. Actually Dorsey had a great game, which is worth monitoring. I did not watch that. I'm not sure if you did either, because it was in the middle of the day. But that's sort of the news item. Did that surprise you at all? Number one, and you know, Dorsey having a big game. There was some excitement about that when we tweeted it out from the Peach Troops account. People were sort of excited about that. Put that in context for me as well.
I mean, I think it's interesting that they waited so late. I would imagine that these guys were in Wisconsin for the game a lot earlier than when they announced it officially. But, you know, I think it's fine. I think it's interesting. It's good that Dorsey played well, because he hasn't, always done that for the Hawks, hasn't gotten the consistent playing time like he, you know, was privy to last year. But, you know, 44 minutes, 36 points, 22 shots, 13 of 14 from the foul line, 13 boards. Like, he played well. Like, this, there's no real two ways about that. You know, obviously the G League has some inflated offensive tallies, so to say. But, you know, I think that Dorsey even exceeded that, like, that level of play in this game, especially, you know, being as efficient as he was, contributing on the glass, 5 assists to just 2 turnovers, 2 steals, 2 blocks. So he's doing it on that end too. Like, there's, you know, it's for those of us who sort of surmise that he might be not an NBA player at this juncture in his career, it was a nice sort of reminder that even if he's not like a rotation level NBA player, he's better. He's probably too good for the G League level. So, you know, he's sort of caught in that middle ground between being very good at the G League level and being out of the rotation for a really, really bad team at the NBA level. So where that puts him next year, whether that's overseas or still in the NBA, is sort of an open question. But this is certainly a positive performance for him.
For sure. And, you know, Poitras had 20-8 in the game. I think we both agree is too good for the G League as well. But he's a little bit older, which makes it interesting for him as well. But yeah, Dorsey's, you know, a bigger name to Hawks fans than I think he actually is nationally, just because he was the first, you know, he was the second draft pick for Travis Schlenk. He was a relatively early second round pick. So he'll be around. I'm not sure he'll be around in Atlanta after this year, but we'll see moving forward. But it was definitely good to see him at least play well. It would have been, slightly more worrisome if he went down and struggled. But even then, it's a one game sample in the G League, and numbers are kind of easy to come by, as you sort of mentioned there. So that's the one sort of newsy item to get out of the way. And then there was one more news that I teased yesterday on the podcast, and that I was going to hold it for today's show. And that's because I knew you were coming on with me today. But Jeremy Lin, there was a rumor about Jeremy Lin and the Sacramento Kings showing some interest that I wrote about a little bit at PeachtreeHoops.com, and we'll sort of use this as a springboard. The majority of this podcast, I think, is going to be sort of a trade deadline primer of sorts, talking about, I guess, the three biggest names that we kind of all understand are available. Mark Stein reported shortly after reporting that the Kings had interest in Jeremy Lin, that sort of the obvious thing is that Jeremy Lin, Dwayne Dedman, and Kent Bazemore are available. We kind of knew that already, and we've been talking about it pretty openly kind of all season. But, you know, Mark Stein is one of the bigger names in the industry, one of the more credible guys in terms of news breaking. So that is now publicly out there, I guess, officially, quote unquote. So we'll start with Lin, because he's the most recent name. And obviously, by the way, there was a 3-team report that I covered last week with Philly and New Orleans and Portland as potential teams with him as well. You know, before we get to actual team specific stuff, Jeremy Lin as an asset is really interesting to me because we kind of all know he's a good player. He would help a lot of teams, to be sure, but he's making almost $14 million, and that's tough because on that contract, it doesn't really matter necessarily that much in terms of whether he's a positive value considering it's only an expiring deal, but he's not cheap at $14 million, we'll say that. So, you know, before we get to, I guess, drill down into some team stuff, what is the value of a team trying to get Jeremy Lin, and how hard is it to make a deal involving Jeremy Lin considering the price tag?
I think it's almost, and we're going to get into this with Deadman a little bit later, it's easier to construct a trade for Jeremy Lin because there are a lot of other bad contracts that are in that same range that have money going past this year. Whereas, you know, we'll get into that with Deadman a little bit later, but Jeremy Lin at $13.8 million, the Hawks can take back anywhere between about $8.8 and $18.8 million. There are a lot, that's a big range for them to be able to work in. And there's a lot of guys who are in that range who make money, you know, roughly around the $13.8 million figure for this year and have some money going into next year where the Hawks can take back sort of a worse asset, you know, pick up another draft pick, pick up, you know, the young, either a young player or a draft pick like Travis Schlenk likes to do. And then Lin becomes, in that case, almost like an asset because he's being traded for something a little bit worse than what he is on his contract. Where he is in the grand scheme of, let's say, just a regular year where there weren't a lot of these bad 2016 contracts on teams' books, that's a little bit more complicated. I mean, the 13.8 is not, you know, he's probably not a $13.8 million player, but he's like an $8 or $9 million player. You know, he's not as dead as he was probably over the summer when the Hawks traded for him, because he's been playing very well this year, because he showed he can play in 2-point guard alignments just like he did in Charlotte back in the day with Kemba Walker, and he can play sort of as the primary scorer. You know, obviously his scoring numbers have been really good this year, so you know, I think he's got some value. He's got some value to the right teams, the teams who need some help at the backup point guard spot. That's where the Sacramento rumor came from. That's where the Philly rumor has come from. That's where a lot of the rumors surrounding New Orleans and Portland as well, who, you know, all of those teams are sort of looking to upgrade their backcourt. So I think that's where Lin fits. Obviously, that's the position he plays. So anybody who needs some help at the backup spot and has a particular urgency to improve their team, like Sacramento and like New Orleans in particular, those are the teams that you know, with whom the Hawks should be talking pretty consistently.
For sure. And I don't think, you know, for instance, I think Jeremy Lin would start on some NBA teams credibly. I don't think that the teams that he would start on necessarily are the teams that will be looking to add him right now, because of the fact that most of those teams are bad teams. You know, Orlando and Phoenix are the two very obvious teams where he would be the best point guard by a wide margin. Those teams are not really trying right now. I guess Orlando's not so far out of it that they wouldn't be trying completely, but Phoenix clearly is not trying, and it doesn't make a ton of sense for Orlando to trade for a guy on an expiring deal and try to like push for the playoffs right now, in my opinion. So, I mean, New Orleans, Portland, Philly, those are all playoff teams, or at least teams that want to be playoff teams, and they'd be looking at Lin in more of a supporting, you know, third guard role, which is probably what he's best suited for on a good team right now. So, we could drill down a little bit. The Kings thing is the one team I haven't discussed on this podcast, at least in specific form. It's also a very interesting scenario because the Kings are the only team in the league that has cap space, and that makes it very interesting because most of the time when I'm talking about players being traded, whether it be Lin or Deadman or Bazemore, a lot of the discussion is through the prism of having to match salary. The Kings don't have to do that. It's kind of interesting. They have to send some salary back. They can't just take Lin in for nothing, but it's not a situation where the Hawks have to take $10, $11, $12 million back for Jeremy Lin. It's more like three. So how does that make things interesting for Sacramento, in your opinion? And have you thought of anything that might make sense? Because, I mean, I got a lot of questions. It's clear what the Kings want to do with Jeremy Lin. They would want a backup point guard. They could also play alongside De'Aaron Fox a little bit and just kind of give them an upgrade. But what would the Hawks be interested in there? Because I mentioned Zebo and Costa Kufas as like salary matching options, and fans got upset. I'm like, guys, I'm not telling you that the Hawks want Zebo or the Hawks want Costa Kufas. That's not what that is. The Hawks will have to be getting an asset of some form, whether it be a draft pick or a young player. But what kind of assets do the Kings have that the Hawks might want, and how obvious? I think it's pretty obvious, and I think I tweeted that as well. But how obvious is this fit in terms of Lin?
Yeah, I mean, it's there's the the Kings can do a lot of different things. Like you said, because of their cap space, they have to send out about $2.75 million to bring Lynn in, which is not very much considering he makes $13.8 million. There's no other team that has that kind of space, no other team that has space at all other than Sacramento. There are some teams who could get into some cap space if they made a move or something like that, the Hawks being one of them. Obviously, they're not going to trade for Jeremy Lin because they already have him. But Sacramento can do a lot of different things, so you don't have to match the salary. So Kosta Kufos and Zach Randolph make sense if you want a salary match, and if the Sacramento Kings want to keep their cap space open or use their cap space in another trade, then those two guys come right back in and make more sense for a Jeremy Lin trade later down the line. But for right now, where things stand, you know, a guy like Yogi Ferrell, who only makes $3 million, that works perfectly for both sides. That's a trade that I really like in particular for both teams, only because Ferrell comes out off of the Kings books and Jeremy Lin just replaces him as the backup point guard in their rotation. And so they don't have to sort of figure out how to work so many guards back into their rotation. The Hawks, from their perspective, they get a little bit of extra cap space because they're saving like $10.8 million on their cap. So they'd have, you know, maybe $6 million in cap space to work with on the trade market this year, which would be something to work with after Lin was moved. So if this is a deal that comes together next week, then they would have a couple more weeks to talk to teams about that extra bit of flexibility that might help them. So there's, you know, I think that's the most interesting trade to me. I think Yogi makes $3 million, is on, you know, slated for 3.2 next year, but that's fully non-guaranteed. So the Hawks can just cut him if he doesn't work out for the last few months of the year. I think he's the most interesting one because he at least he's a little younger and has some at least on court upside. Whereas
also he's a point guard, and the Hawks might want one of those at least to take a look at if they are trading their backup point guard.
Sure, if they're trading their backup point guard and Jalen Adams is going to be their backup point guard, maybe it would be nice to bring back Yogi Ferrell, even if he's slightly overpaid at $3 million and he's more of a minimum guy. They need guys who can just fill in minutes at the backup point guard spot. So that's where Yogi Ferrell comes in. I think that would be, you know, an interesting flyer for them to take. There are a lot of other guys, you know, younger guys on the Kings who, you know, on whom I think a flyer would make sense. We talked about Scott Labissiere offline as a guy who would just be really interesting for the Hawks to go grab if it was, you know, Zebo and a second round pick and Scal. That would just be sort of an interesting flyer to take on a young guy who, you know, hasn't gotten a lot of good opportunity in Sacramento. So there's a lot of good deals to be made with Sacramento. I think the big thing for a Kings trade with the Hawks is what kind of draft assets the Kings have. That's the real big thing, because whoever they take back, the Hawks are in this for draft picks. That's what they want. That's what they're going to go for. And the Kings have a ton of them. They're not a lot of first-round picks. They have their own first-round picks from 2020 on, but that's not really what we're talking about with Jeremy Lin for the most part. Unless it's really like Lin for Zach Randolph, then maybe we're talking about a first-round pick. But even then, there might be some second-round picks that are more valuable than Sacramento's own firsts, you know, considering.
Yeah, I mean, before we get to into the specifics of all the picks that Sacramento has, and that's definitely worth pointing out. You know, Travis Schlenk on this pod talked about how that was, you know, pretty candidly about how all these trades, basically they'll be looking for draft picks and or young players. And I think young players in this instance, there's nobody on Sacramento's roster that they actually would trade. Obviously, Buddy Hield's not going to be traded by Sacramento, or Willie Cauley-Stein. The guys you'd be talking about or Harry Giles, maybe, or Justin Jackson, or Scal Labissiere. Those guys are not worth first-round picks right now on the market. So that's kind of what you're talking about, those guys and picks. And to the first-round point on Jeremy Lin, I think the only way you're getting a first-rounder, I think you were just sort of saying that as well, is maybe if Zebo is attached, you might be able to swindle a first-round pick from the Kings. But I would assume, barring them just pulling a Kings and doing something very silly, it'd be pretty heavily protected and probably a long way in the future, because their own pick this year is too much in that deal. Their own pick this year is going to be a pretty decent pick. So I can't imagine they're going to be one to attach that pick.
Yeah. They don't own their own pick, so they can't trade it. They're already going to Boston.
That's already long gone.
We're talking 2021 or later, so it's not that's not a great pick.
Yeah, and I was thinking, like, I knew it was top one Anyway, that's a weird pick, by the way.
Yeah, it's top one to Philly, and the rest of it goes to Boston.
And the
it's
rest
very
of it's
strange.
Boston, yeah.
But that's Sacramento has no portion of it, so they can't trade any portion of it, which also means they can't trade their 2020 pick because of the Stepien rule. So now we're talking about 2021 or later. So their first-round picks are not, you know, assuming you think that this team is on a positive trajectory, which from this year looks like they are with De'Aaron Fox, Marvin Bagley, Buddy Hield, you know, even Willie Cauley-Stein, if he's back, like this, the, you know, the Kings are probably by 2021 probably going to be pretty good, you would
I
hope.
Will say, yeah, I mean, I will say, because Schlenk has now said both here and an interview with The Athletic and other places that he doesn't necessarily want 2019 picks, you can actually probably coax some value out of a 2021 pick. I do think that, you know, if it was offered to me right now today, if it was Zebo and the 2021 pick for Jeremy Lin, a first round pick, I would probably do that trade. That's probably good value in my opinion. But that trade, I mean, that pick is not as valuable as one that's closer. That's just the way of, that's sort of the natural way to evaluate draft picks. So I think you're probably looking at second rounders and young players, which is kind of where you were headed there. But I just think it's important to note that, like, I understand the thought process is like, okay, go get a first round pick for Jeremy Lin. He's good. I'm like, yes, he is. But he's also an expiring contract who makes a lot of money. And I can't imagine that you're going to get a first round pick without taking some bad money back, which Zebo is bad money, but it's only this year. So that sort of also lessens their desire to get off of him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would think that Sacramento would do this deal to get better immediately and to try to make a real playoff run, because Zebo's not really helping them and Jeremy Lin would really help them. And then for that, the upgrade in talent is almost what you would be what the Sacramento would be paying a first round pick for, really, because everybody expires at the end of this year anyway. There's no the difference in value in terms of their contracts is not as important, because there's not an off season that player takes up some of your cap space. The upgrade from Zebo to Jeremy Lin would be worth paying a first round pick, maybe, if the Hawks can get that out. Probably it's more like a second. They have a ton of them. They have 9 second round picks in the next 3 years. So there's a ton of good ones in there. And it's just really about what you can, the hang up would be which two would come with Zebo, probably for Jeremy Lin, or even Kostas Koufos if they want to go that route, or maybe one second round pick if they want to go the Yogi Ferrell route. So, you know, those are the three names that I would be watching in regards to this trade. So where they end up, if it ends up going to Sacramento, you know, we'll certainly, I mean, not certainly, but I would imagine that we'll probably hear about it one way or the other, because the Kings have some leaks in their boat for sure. And the Hawks haven't been exactly as tight-lipped as they were the last few years either. So I would imagine that if there are significant discussions between these two teams, we're going to hear about it.
Yeah, and it's important to note for now that this is just interest, in the same way that it was reported for Philly and New Orleans. And it's not anything that we know of at this point. It's like super advanced discussions. It's not like we're centering on this, and that's why I don't want to spend too much more time on it. But I got a lot of questions about what it would look like. So there it is. And I do think second round picks are the most likely currency when you're talking about Jeremy Lin and Dwayne Dedman, who we can transition into now. Again, I'd be pretty surprised if the Hawks got a first round pick in either deal involving Lin or Dedman, unless they're taking bad money back, and probably bad money into the future in order to get a first round pick for either one of those guys. Bazemore is a little bit more complicated because he is a guy who has money in the future, and that almost certainly is going to involve bad money coming back. And then you probably talk more about, and by the way, he's just a better player as well. But that's what you're talking about. I know fans don't really like second round picks very much. I got a lot of like, oh, second round pick's great. Like I understand, but for a guy who probably isn't going to be around long-term in Jeremy Lin or Dwayne Dedman, really, but especially Lin, who's a little bit older and is clearly a backup on this particular roster with Trae Young around, you're not going to get better than that, probably. You're looking for a situation where you're trying to get an asset. You by the way, you got an asset to take on Lin as well. It wasn't a very good one. It was not. It was a future second-round pick. It's not like it was an impressive asset, but you got something to take him on. He's played well for you, and if you can also trade him after 40, 50 games and get another asset back, that's reasonable asset management, and it's kind of what you're looking for.
Yeah, and a second-round pick in general is probably not that good, but if you can work a second-round pick that might be in the top 10,
well, that's what
good.
I mean, the people, you know. I think somebody asked me this the other day, like what the dividing line is. I've always thought of top 45, but especially top 40 picks are just a little bit different. Like picks at the end of the second round, you could hit on them, but the hit rate is very, very low down there. Whereas if you get a pick in the top 37, 38, 39, 40, you know, it's not an exact science, and you could certainly miss on those picks. We saw the Hawks. I think Dorsey at 41 is kind of a pretty baseline outcome. Like 41 is like you might find someone who's a fringe NBA player, and that's not a bad pick. I never loved that pick, but it wasn't like that was a disaster pick. He's been an NBA player for 2 years. He doesn't embarrass himself when he's on the court. That's kind of what you're looking at, but you can hit. Obviously, there are success stories. There are a lot of them, especially in the early part of the second round. And moreover, it's just another swing, frankly. Like, it doesn't mean the Hawks are going to even take it, but it's another asset to trade. There's another player you can add. And I think the dividing line for me is somewhere in that top, 42 range that you would want. And Sacramento has so many options that you can sort of reasonably pick, especially if you do it close to now, like 2019 or 2020, you can sort of figure out who's going to have good, sort of which one of those picks are going to be better, because you kind of know which teams own them. And, if it's Cleveland's, it's not Cleveland's, but I'm trying to pick up the worst team. If it's somebody that's really bad and their second round pick, that's a good value. Like, for instance, the Hawks' second round pick this year is going to be a pretty good pick. It's going to be top 36, 37. That's a good pick. Whereas if you talk about the Warriors' second round pick, that's not really valuable.
Right. Yeah. That's what I would get at with the second rounders. Like, they, more so. Well, probably not more so than the first rounders, because obviously the first rounders at the very top of the draft are very important. But the difference between the 35th pick and the 55th pick is really, between basically like a rotation level NBA player and not an NBA player, and just like a draft and stash guy, or just some guy who you, have for maybe a year and that's the end of it. But, so I think the value of the second round picks will, does change as you obviously go down the order of the draft here.
For sure. And we'll talk more about Lynn stuff in the future. Let's transition into Dedmon and then Bazemore quickly here. Dedmon is much like Lynn in the fact that he's an expiring contract. He's a fringe starter kind of player. I think he started on a lot of teams as a starting center. And at the very worst, he's a very, very good backup center. And he's a little bit cheaper than Lynn. So it might be easier in some ways, but big men are available, let's just say. Those guys might get bought out. Dedmon is better than the guys you would get on the buyout market. But for instance, like Robin Lopez is very available. That's someone who is a comparable player to Dwayne Dedmon. He makes more money, but he might be getting bought out. It sort of complicates the market with big men, is because he's a one position player. As much as Dedmon sort of functioned as a power forward for a few minutes this year against alongside Alex Lynn, he's still a center. So it's a little bit more tricky. Do you have any teams you're looking at for Dwayne Dedmon that are available? I think it's clear that the Hawks are going to be having him on the market, but trying to nail down, a lot of teams could use him, but trying to figure out, how to match salary, how to get him to land in a spot that makes a lot of sense for all parties isn't necessarily all that easy.
Yeah, and I think this was what I was alluding to earlier with Dedmon's salary. He makes almost too little. Like, he makes $7.2 million. Right. If he made $10 million, he'd be a lot easier to trade, which makes no sense. But other than the fact that the marketplace has so many contracts that are sort of in that, low teens, 13, 14, 15 million, that Dedmon can't be traded one for one for, because that's too much money for the Hawks to take back for his 7.2 million. On his 7.2, they can only take back 12.2, which doesn't get into the guys who make, even a guy like Brandon Knight, who makes 14.6. They can't do that. Like, Dedmon to Knight doesn't work.
And the Hawks don't have that, middle tier salary to even pair with him. Like, the three guys that we're talking about here are the guys who we know are just very available in Lynn, Bazemore, and Dedmon. They don't even have that filler salary. Like, they don't have that $3 million piece like that Sacramento has. Going back to that, like, Yogi Ferrell would be a great partner in crime, like someone who makes $3 million that's super available. The Hawks don't really have that. The guys who we know that they would probably trade are the guys on the minimums, and then everybody else is either on a rookie deal that they don't want to trade, or they're veterans that are really expensive. They don't really have that even piece to pair with Dedmon to make up more salary. There's no mid-salary on this team. He's really the only guy that's making a mid-tier salary that's not on a rookie contract.
Yeah, and so that makes it difficult for just to match salary on him. And so, I think Houston is the big one that I would watch with them. They're the team who can use a center immediately, because Clint Capella just went down for about 4 to 6 weeks through injury. Capella's had his issues this year, sort of came into camp out of shape, worked his way into shape. Now he's hurt. There are reasons to be, if you're trying to win a championship as the Rockets are, there are reasons to be a little bit skeptical of what Capella has given them this year and what he might give them in a playoff setting. So, Dedmon would be somebody who would be very interesting there, both as a short-term starter while Capella is sitting, and a long-term backup if they get into a playoff series against a bigger team. Say they come up against somebody that they didn't expect to come up against, and all of a sudden they can't really get away with P.J. Tucker at center anymore, and they need Dwayne Dedman, or they need a backup center. Would you rather have Dwayne Dedman or Nene? And that's where, you know, that's where Dedman comes in. And Dedman has such an interesting skill set for them in particular, because he can shoot the three, because he doesn't, when he's on the floor, it's not necessarily that Dedman has to be the one setting the screen in pick and roll situations like it does with Capella, because he can space to the corner. He can sit in the corner and shoot threes from there. So the Rockets, as they love to do, can matchup hunt. They can pick the other team's worst defender, and whoever that guy's guarding, that guy comes up and sets the screen for James Harden or Chris Paul. That's something that sort of would be easier with Dwayne Dedman on the floor, because Dedman can space out to the corner because he doesn't have to be involved in the primary action. Valuable to them offensively. And then, of course, defensively, he's not Clint Capella, but for a backup center, he's better than Nene and is solid in that way, and is bigger than a guy like P.J. Tucker. Obviously not as good defensively as P.J. Tucker, but in a situation where the other team plays two big men. I mean, I'm not saying that they would run up against Indiana in the finals.
Sure.
But against DeMontis Sabonis, P.J. Tucker is going to struggle in that situation. I'm just saying.
Or OKC, or somebody like, I mean, somebody that's capable of playing two bigs credibly.
Sure.
That makes sense. I think Dedman is interesting because, again, I don't think he's going to be traded to a team that's going to want him to start in the playoffs, but he would help almost any team in the playoffs. Like, there are very few teams that have a backup center better than Dwayne Dedman. Like, maybe none. There's very few teams in the league that have two centers better than Dwayne Dedman. So he would help a lot of teams. Like, even, you know, I've heard Philly floated out there. Like, he's an upgrade on Muscala. As much as I've always liked Muscala, Dedman's a lot better player than Muscala. And they could certainly use him. That's a team that is always active in trade stuff. There are teams around the league that Dedman would make sense for. It's just, how much do those teams value that upgrade at backup center? Houston became even more obvious in the absence of Capella, because they might want to fill these 4 weeks with a better player and try to, you know, play off positioning. Why? They really can't afford to just kind of go in the tank for 4 weeks. They won't, because Harden's so good, but they really could use that guy right now. Whereas most of these teams are angling for the playoffs more so than a marginal win in January, February, March. So that's kind of the tricky part as well, is that just how much is that worth to a team? Like, everyone could use him, but is it a second round pick? Do they want to see if it gets bought out? How much urgency is there to, A, on the Hawks end? Because I'm not 100% sure that the Hawks are going to trade him. I mean, last year we knew almost certainly they were going to trade Ilyasova and Bellinelli come hell or high water, unless they just couldn't do it. With Bellinelli, they couldn't do it. With Ilyasova, he turned down a couple of offers because he had no trade clause. Dedman does not have a no trade clause, and I'm confident they can trade him. I'm just not sure how badly they want to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it would have to be something not super significant, but they would have to get something back for him that makes sense. I mean, I think it's the same thing with Jeremy Lin, though I think there's less urgency to trade Dedman than there is Lin, just because he's a good player. He's fine to have around. He's a good guy to have in the locker room. He's, you know, part of their starting units that, when fully healthy, have been pretty good this year. He's part of he's probably not part of their long-term plans, but he's more of a part of their long-term. There's a bit higher percentage chance he's part of their long-term plans than a guy like Jeremy Lin. So,
yeah, he's a little bit younger. I can't imagine they're going to make him a priority to re-sign. But if Dedman just likes it, and Pierce likes him, and Schlenk likes him, it wouldn't blow me out of the water if they brought him back. Like, it's not like it's going to be – I wouldn't predict that. But they don't. It's not a situation where you're talking about Marco Bellinelli, and he's 35 years old. He's just not going to come back. Dedman is a reasonable guy they could sign next summer. It wouldn't, like, stun me beyond measure.
No, not at all. And so it would be, you know, the urgency to trade him will have to come from the teams who want to acquire him. And if they can, you know, if the Hawks can set up a little bit of a bidding war between Houston and some of these other, you know, high end contenders, it'll be, you know, they might be able to wrangle a pair of second round picks and, you know, and whoever needs to salary match. That might make sense. You know, I think a team that hasn't been discussed with him and he's got some experience with is Milwaukee, because Bud is the coach there. Bud had him in Atlanta last year. They love a guy who can shoot at the center position. He can back up, you know, Brooke Lopez and basically be Brooke Lopez 2.0 off the bench. He can shoot from outside, not as well as Lopez has shown this year. He can probably defend at a reasonable level compared to Lopez, like probably a little bit better. I liked Edmund a little bit better than Lopez defensively. He's not as big, but he's a little more mobile. Yeah. As a backup center, he'd be fine for them. I mean, he's better than what they're throwing out there now. And, you know, they've got Jason Smith, who is right now playing a little bit for them, but is clearly would be a nice upgrade. Yeah, I mean, it would be a very good upgrade for them to go from Jason Smith to Dwayne Dedman off the bench.
Yeah, and, I mean, I'm not sure that that's like a point of. I think that'd probably be like a last ditch effort for Milwaukee because they have Thon too, which Thon isn't as good as Dwayne Dedman, but that's another option. But at the end of the day, if you get to February 6th and you're Milwaukee and you're just looking around like, what can we do without hurting ourselves long term? Oh, Dwayne Dedman. Like, it's a pretty easy fit to, like, okay, Jason Smith in a second-round pick, call it in. It's, like, a pretty easy trade that's just kind of sitting there. And there are a few of those around the league where it might be not – it's not sexy at all because Milwaukee second-round picks are not good, et cetera. But if it's just, like, get something for Dedman, if that's the mandate from the front office, if Travis Schlenk is just like, you know what, we're not going to re-sign him, let's get something I could sell to my fan base, you know, that's an option.
Yeah, and Jason Smith, because he's on the Milwaukee Bucks from the Washington Wizards – Milwaukee has a pair of Washington's second round picks in 2020 and 21. So it's not that you have to take the 55th pick from Milwaukee, because that is really like we're getting down into the dregs of the second round.
Oh, that's a virtually useless pick.
Yeah.
Really.
But a Washington second round pick in 2020 is not super useless. In 2021 also is not super useless. So, you know, if you can get one or maybe even both of those in a Jason Smith, you know, Dwayne Dedman swap, I think that would be particularly interesting. Maybe you get one of those and a Milwaukee one just in case Milwaukee happens to be bad one year, especially if you get
if
one.
Leaves.
Yeah, if you get one far enough out in, you know, 2022 or 2023 from Milwaukee after Giannis's contract is up, maybe he's not there anymore. Maybe they drop down a little bit. You know, you take that you price that into the percentage chance that he leaves or he, you know, has an off year or whatever, you know, something that happens with their team. So, you know, you could talk yourself into a later Milwaukee pick or one of these upcoming Washington picks or maybe one of each for Dedman as an upgrade over Smith. There are a couple other places that might make sense for him. You know, the Los Angeles Clippers, Marcin Gortat's the starter, but he's, you know, so Dedman's probably better than him. Montrezl Harrell has been really good coming off the bench, but they've had problems scaling him up into a starter level role just because of his size issues and such. So, you know, that might be interesting. You know, Avery Bradley would be the guy to watch there, I think, if the Clippers wanted to trade for Dedman. And then Golden State, they would never in 2 million years do this, but Sean Livingston is not really, you know, helping them as much as they want him to. And Dedman, as DeMarcus Cousins insurance as a backup center off the bench would really help them in a way that Livingston kind of isn't. You know, they would have to do something about the backup point guard spot, but I think Livingston is sort of seen better days. I don't think Golden State would do this, both personally and professionally and just their whole team chemistry thing. I don't think that they would do this, but that was, you know, a name to watch perhaps.
Yeah, and then they might fall into Robin Lopez too, and at that point it wouldn't necessarily matter.
That's true.
But yeah, there's a few of those teams that, again, same with Lynn. I think you're looking at playoff teams that they're going to want Dwayne Dedman. I can't see a scenario where a bad team's going to want him because he's going to expire and probably leave, and cap hold is not small enough for it to matter, et cetera, et cetera. I think that, you know, it's playoff teams you're looking at. So just, you know, look around the league for medium sized salaries. And as Jeff noted, it's a lot harder to trade sometimes that kind of mid tier salary than it is the bigger ones, even if just theoretically. Unless you have anything else to add on Dedman, I want to ask you about Bazemore. And, you know, Bazemore is interesting is that he's not playing still, and that really hurts. I mean, I'm not sure when he's going to come back. There's no definitive update. He has not started practicing yet. And I think, you know, we're, you know, 500 hours or so, as I looked it up this morning, from the deadline. That's not a long time. I think it's pretty easy to still think of a way for the Hawks to move Bazemore because he's a pretty well-established player. It isn't like a serious injury. It's an ankle. It's sort of lingering, but it's not like a situation where he's this untapped resource. You kind of know what he is, and as a result, you could still trade him if he is injured, but it makes it harder. Just as another obstacle in the way alongside his big-time salary, and I know next year is a player option, but we kind of all expect that to be picked up. I've sort of been leading the charge that it's not 100% guaranteed that he picks it up, but I think it's very, very likely that he does. So I'm sort of treating that as locked in money for 2019-20. So with all that said, we know the obvious candidates. It's Houston, it's New Orleans. But is there a sleeper on your mind, or is there a favorite scenario on your mind where Bazemore is dealt somewhere? Because we know what it's going to be, a team that wants wing help, which is almost everyone, but it's a team that kind of wants to go all in because he has that salary for next year.
Yeah, and it's going to have to. I mean, the Houston and New Orleans ones make so much sense that those are really the two that you have to look at. It's Solomon Hill and some salary filler to make that work, or Brandon Knight and whatever else that the Houston Rockets or the New Orleans Pelicans can attach in that pick and, you know, to that trade to make it work for Bazemore. The injury, of course, like you said, is really tough because what you're getting Bazemore for this year, and if you're, you know, hopefully, I mean, if you're Houston and New Orleans, you know, hopefully you're planning to be good again next year, especially New Orleans with their situation with Anthony Davis. But in Houston, they're going to be good next year. So Bazemore, even at $19.3 million, will be a useful piece for them, and they're willing to spend the money to a certain extent and go after a guy like that, especially since they're trading out $14 million in Brandon Knight. So, you know, the upgrade from Knight to Bazemore is worth that extra $5 million plus whatever it would count for on the luxury tax. So, you know, I think the Houston makes so much sense that it's surprising almost that it hasn't happened yet. But I think the Bazemore injury this year has sort of slowed things down a little bit in that, you know, he's been on the shelf. What he's going to look like on the way back is going to be interesting. So, you know, I think that's why we haven't seen something already from the Houston perspective. You know, I think New Orleans would be a second place favorite for Bazemore at this point, but Houston is the one who, you know, it just makes so much sense that it's almost surprising that it hasn't happened yet.
I totally agree. And listen, I mean, it's just so we say this yet again, probably for the fifth time, if they were to trade Bazemore for Brandon Knight, it would not be to acquire Brandon Knight. That's not the reason why the Hawks would be doing that trade. They'd be trying to get a first-round pick from Houston or multiple. I've long said that I think it should take multiple picks, maybe a first and a second, something, because I think the gap between Bazemore, even for next year, and Knight for next year, I know Knight is a little bit cheaper, but Bazemore is a full-blown starting caliber wing. Brandon Knight might be dead money. He may not be, but he might be dead money for next year. So that's a $15 million gap in effectiveness, and that's a first-round pick on its own, plus this year. So it's kind of a situation where if the Hawks just called in a Bazemore for Knight in the first-round pick trade, I wouldn't kill him for it. It makes some sense on all sides, and I think a first-round pick is valuable. But with what Travis Schlenk has said about not necessarily prioritizing 2019 picks, most teams want picks that are closer to now. But the Hawks may not, because they have the extra pick for this year. They have all these young guys already. They have these extra second-round picks. They have a ton of second-round value already for 2019. They might really want future assets. And if you're trading with Houston, you would almost prefer a future asset, because you kind of know what they are now. Like, they're pretty good. That pick's going to be somewhere in the 20s, you'd imagine. And if it's 2 years from now or 3 years from now, you're getting that pick, there's some more fluctuation there. So anyway, I think for all the reasons that you said, Houston's very obvious. New Orleans, same thing around Solomon Hill. Is there a sleeper team that we should be watching for? That's a question I get a lot, is like, okay, we've heard about Houston, we've heard about New Orleans. Is there another team that might make sense? I have a hard time finding one that's like super obvious, but maybe we can get creative. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, this one is more difficult because the focus has been so heavily on Houston and New Orleans. There are, I mean, every team needs wing help. Like, you can never have too many wings. So there are, you know, other teams out there, you know, in Indiana perhaps, but they don't have a ton of salary match that makes sense for them. So they'd have to piece together a couple of different players. Plus, they want expiring, you know, the fact that Bazemore doesn't expire makes it even more difficult, because, you know, they want expiring contracts because they're trying to be big in free agency this summer. You know, maybe the Clippers want to add another guy, but they're also, you know, have cap space aspirations this summer. It's more difficult to find, you know, a situation for Bazemore in that sense. You know, maybe going back to Sacramento, there might be something there because they have a ton of cap space for this summer, but now aren't at that same level that they expect to be able to lure a couple of big time free agents. You know, does it make sense there? They would, you know, add another wing, another good player who could help them with a playoff push. Yeah, maybe Denver, but I doubt it. I mean, those are the types of teams that maybe would be looking into it. Like a team that is not the one of the very best teams in the league, but are sort of in that tier right below where Bazemore could help them shore up some wing depth and push them, you know, perhaps over the top in their specific conference.
Yep, that's it. I mean, it's got to be a team that's not averse to taking on the long-term money, because that's the big thing with Bazemore. If he was expiring, it'd be a lot easier to trade him, and he'd have a lot more value. But next year is, you know, he's worth starter money, but he's not worth $19 million on the open market for next year. So that's something to keep in mind, too. He's still a slightly negative asset. I don't think you'll find anybody that's as high on him as I am. Maybe you will, but I doubt it. I'm huge on Kent Bazemore. I think he's a full-blown starting player in the league, but he's still a little bit overpaid. So that's at least part of the calculus with the discussion around Bay. So, okay, I'm gonna sort of wrap this up on those three guys just to say, who is the most likely to be traded? Who is the least likely to be traded in your mind? By the way, we are fully guessing. This is not sourced. We're just guessing.
Of those three guys, the most likely to be traded is Jeremy Lin, because he makes a salary that makes sense. There's more incentive to trade him. All the stuff that we've been talking about with him, there are more teams that have been specifically linked to him. In terms of the four teams we mentioned, Sacramento being the most recent of those. Sacramento is interesting because they've got all that cap space. They can work a deal that makes, you know, that is more flexible than a lot of other teams can do. So I think Lin is the most likely to be traded. Then Dedmon is probably the second most likely, because Bazemore has that extra money for next year. Bazemore will be just, you know, unless something happens injury-wise, Bazemore is going to be just as tradable this time next year. In fact, probably more tradable, because he's expiring, because teams will see how their cap space next year will have shaken out. He'll be expiring at the end of the 2019-20 season. So we'll be sitting in sort of a similar situation to Jeremy Lin right now, where he'll be slightly overpaid but expiring. So a good team will be able to take him on without, you know, really worrying about their long-term future. So I think Bazemore for this particular year, because he's injured right now and is not sort of upping his value on the market as we speak, and because he's got that money for next year, he's probably least likely to be traded.
I think I agree across the board. I think, you know, I would certainly predict that the Hawks make at least one trade between now and the deadline. I'm not sure they're going to trade all three. I'm not sure they're going to trade even two of the three. I think that it's pretty likely that they at least make one trade out of these three guys. They could make another trade as well. You know, Torian Prince's name has been floating out there, not quite as hardly sourced and reported, but a few people have mentioned that. Kevin O'Connor recently did on the Ringer podcast. He's plugged in around the league. There are people that have at least floated the notion of Torian Prince being available. I've not necessarily heard that. It wouldn't stun me, because he was not a Travis Lane draft pick, but we'll save that for later, because Torian is a much, much more complicated case, because he's on a rookie deal. He's younger. He probably, you know, at least theoretically is part of the future. So a lot more different dynamics in play with him. So before I let you get out of here, man, I do want to ask you sort of about a little bit of actual basketball stuff right now. And that is the fact that the Hawks have been playing well recently. They're 8-7 in their last 15 games, which is kind of jarring. To be fair, their net rating isn't quite as good as that number, and I think it's a little bit of good fortune. For instance, six of the eight wins were against some pretty bad teams: the Wizards, the Knicks, the Pistons, a bad Wolves team when they were playing them, Cleveland and Miami, who didn't show up on a Sunday. So schedule's been kind of favorable, but still, they beat the Sixers on the road. That was a pretty good win, even without Embiid. And then, of course, the demolition of Oklahoma City on Tuesday, which was stunning to everyone, including you and I. So with that as the backdrop, what do you make of this run, and especially what they did on Tuesday? Because that was one where everything came together to the point where even Lloyd Pierce had this like kind of wry smile, like he kind of knew that was like the perfect storm. But still, they did it, and they put 142 up on the Thunder. So what do you make of this most recent run for the Hawks?
I mean, I think it's something to note long-term more than short-term. I think it's something that we'll, especially for the Thunder game, it's something that we'll look back on the end of the year, and when they're, you know, if they have 30 wins at the end of the year, 25 to 30 wins, I think you'll look back at the Oklahoma City win and be like, that was their best win of the year. That was their best wire-to-wire performance, especially offensively, of the year.
It certainly is now, by the way. So far, it's definitely sure. Number one on the list.
So does that necessarily mean that this is going to be a consistent thing for the rest of the year? Probably not. But even getting an inconsistent good team with lots of consistent bad stuff throughout the rest of the year is better than what it's been in, you know, over the last year and a half or so. You know, I think it's something that you can look at this as a harbinger for the long-term future, but not necessarily the short-term future, I don't think. If it's something where Young, Herter and Collins can play this way, you know, three out of every four nights, or even two out of every four nights. Okay, now, I mean, you know, now we're talking about right now. But I think, you know, I think we're talking still about the 2020-2021 season as the year that the Hawks are should be targeting really getting back into the playoff mix. It's really not this year. It's probably not next year unless they, you know, get Zion Williamson, and then all of a sudden everybody sort of takes that leap forward, plus Zion is as good as people think he's going to be. So, you know, there's a chance that 2020 is the next playoff year, but it's really, you know, I think I'm looking toward 2021 as their next, you know, real playoff push, at least in, you know, in an Eastern Conference. Give the guys a little more time to sort of to grow and to mature and to get this, to get these kind of performances more consistently. I think the consistency is the biggest thing with NBA guys, and getting this sort of performance once a month is pretty good for a young team, but you're not getting that, you know, one out of every two nights for this team in particular, because they're just so young.
Yes, since you brought it up, I do think that there is a path to a playoff berth next season because they're in the East. If they were in the West, I would not say that. But because the East, you get the playoffs with 37, 38 wins, that isn't out of the realm of possibility for, you know, 16 months from now, just because they could probably try to do that. Maybe add, you know, you mentioned Zion, but maybe make a sort of a splashy add in free agency, etc. I wouldn't necessarily encourage that behavior in terms of adding, but with natural growth, like, for instance, if Trae Young made a leap next year or John Collins made another leap, that's not insane. But I generally agree with you that it's the following year that you're probably looking at. I asked you this in part to attack some of this because, you know, predictably after Tuesday night, there was a lot of, some of it was joking, but some of it was actually serious chatter about the Hawks making a playoff run now because of how bad the East is. I will just say this. I tweeted this out on purpose, and I've been doing this every couple days, all season long, a couple of projection systems that just sort of set the stage. I have it in one tweet thread, so if you want to go back and find it, it's definitely there. You can sort of chronicle the whole season. But as of earlier today on Wednesday, there are five systems that I track: 538, Team Rankings, Number Fire, Basketball Reference, and ESPN's BPI. All five of them had the Hawks projected to win between 24 and 28 games, and that seems right. I think they certainly could get to 30 if they tried hard all season long, and if they avoided injuries, and if they kept Bazemore, and if they kept Deadman and maybe Lynn, they could certainly push into that 30 category. But I don't think that reasonably we can't project them to get into the 30s this year. It's possible because they are playing a lot better now than they were before, and if they keep this level up, you know, if they had John Collins all year and they hadn't started the season as bad as they did, 30 would have been a pretty realistic goal. But from here, when you're talking about a team that, you know, at this particular moment is 14-30, to get to 30 wins, you got to play 500 ball the rest of the season, essentially. So, you know, I don't know. It's not insane. It's just a situation where you have to look forward and talk about what they're going to be able to do. I do think that it's a very, very encouraging stretch. That's something we have to keep saying out loud. John Collins playing well is a really good thing. Trae Young's been shooting the ball well quietly for about 3 weeks now. Nice to see. Kevin Huerter had a huge game in Philly. There's lots of positive things to discuss. I'm not trying to throw cold water on it, but I think the playoff stuff is a little bit out of hand. Are they better than New York? Are they better than Cleveland? Are they better than even Phoenix and Chicago? I would say yes. I think it's pretty clear at this point the Hawks are not a bottom four team. They're certainly not. There are definitely three teams that the Hawks are better than, full stop, and that is New York, Cleveland, and Chicago. They are not in that tier. Maybe I speak for myself on this one. Do you agree or disagree with that? I think they're definitely not a bottom three team right now.
Yeah, they're definitely not a bottom three team. They're probably better than Phoenix. Even
I think so too. That was a little bit less clear, but I think they are better than Phoenix too.
Yeah, I would say that they are better than Phoenix right now, and I would say that, but they're not better than anybody else above them in the standings as well.
Yeah,
if we're
talking
about they have to play 500 ball for the rest of the season to hit 30 wins, any talk of the playoffs is just insane.
Yeah, I did the math a little bit wrong there. If they play 500 ball the rest of the season, I'm doing the math in my head now. They play 38 more games. They would win 33 games, not 30. So my apologies.
Okay.
But
still, I mean, 33 is not getting you into the playoffs. Maybe
it's not, and 500 ball is aggressive.
Yeah, so it's not. It's a nice win. It's something that they can even look back on 2 years from now and be like, remember that Oklahoma City game where we just blew them out of the water? That was the first, maybe not the first time, but that's the night that we really thought like, oh, wow, like this team might be very special offensively someday, you know? And it's something that can happen once in a blue moon, once a month, once every couple of weeks. Maybe they go on this little run where they're good offensively, but they're still, you know, it's the consistency factor, and it's the, you know, we'll see. They're going to play Boston. They have obviously the rest of their schedule still to play. We're going to see, you know, maybe this is the new norm. Maybe they just flipped a switch and they're going to be an all-world offensive team for the rest of the year. Probably not. You know, it's just, that's the way these things work. That the team is going to be, you know, if they can get to 28 wins and are the fifth worst team in the league, that's the most likely outcome, I would think, at this point.
Yeah, I think it is possible that, including this stretch and the rest of the season, that they play like a team in the next tier above them, which is basically, you know, Orlando, Detroit, maybe Memphis, that kind of tier. Like, they might be in that tier in terms of their actual present-day performance, but because they started so poorly, it won't look like that in the standings. That is possible for me. They might be a team that's, like, maybe the eighth worst team in the league. That wouldn't surprise me. Or maybe the 10th worst team in the league the rest of the season. But because of how bad they started, they're probably going to finish with the fifth worst record, just because they have even now, after this run where they went 8-7 or 15 game stretch, they're still, you know, 4.5-5 games behind everybody else. That's, you know, they're clearly in fifth kind of by themselves. Right now they have 14 wins. The Knicks have 10. The Cavs have 9. The Suns have 11. You know, the Bulls have 10. The Hawks have 3 more wins than that, 4 more wins than that. So they're kind of in their own tier right now, like almost more than any team in the league, which is kind of funny. You don't really see 4-game cushions between teams anywhere. And the Hawks have 4 games on either side of them right now in the standings. That's kind of wild if you think about it.
Early in the year where it's not necessarily super early, but you know, you go down the list and everything is 1, 1.5, 2, a half game, you know, stuff like that between teams. And the Hawks are really, you know, 4 games back of Washington and 3.5 games up on Phoenix. They're really in their own little tier. The second worst tier from the bottom of the league, where they'll probably sit for the rest of the year, and they're going to have the fifth best odds going into the draft. And, you know, we'll see what happens on lottery night.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's, you know, it's too early to talk about that stuff specifically, but I think it's pretty easy to project in some ways. And if you asked me before the season if the Hawks would go 8-7 over 15 games at any point, I would have said no. So it's pretty encouraging in a lot of ways. Again, the schedule was kind of favorable, but still, they went out and won games. They were not favored in any of those games. Maybe they were favored against Cleveland. I can't remember off the top of my head, but they were the underdog in all those games, and they won them. So, you know, shouts to the Hawks for that. They have a pretty grueling road trip coming up, to the point where the schedule itself, in terms of their opponents, isn't that crazy, but they have a 7-game road trip over 13 days. Teams like the Hawks, with as young as they are and as you know, spotty as they can be, usually do not have success on road trips like that. And then even before they leave, they have Boston, who I think is pretty motivated right now on Saturday. So we'll see how they can keep this up. But at the very least, full stop, this is a very encouraging 15-game run. And again, 8-7 over 15 games for this team at any point is awesome. So shouts to the Hawks on that. Before I let you go, man, I do want to have you plug, sort of pseudo plug. It's not out there in the world yet, but I've seen this. You wrote about the Hawks this week. That's something that's going to go up on Friday morning about one particular area. And I don't want you to spoil it all, but please tease it to the best of your ability.
I'm going to write about turnovers. It's already written. It's ready to go. It's almost scheduled, I think. But it'll go up on Friday on PeachtreeHoops.com, where you can read about all sorts of different turnover stats that, even with the win over Oklahoma City and even with the way that they've been playing over the last, you know, couple of weeks, over the last 15 games, the turnovers are just astronomical. And I get into it, like specifically into the numbers, into how they compare to the rest of their peers this year, how they compare over the last 15 years to, you know, turnover percentage over the last 15 years. It's really bad. You know, even now, even after they've been playing a little bit better recently, they just turn the ball over like it's what they're supposed to be doing. Like it almost feels sometimes like they turn the ball over so much and so much more often than other teams do this year in particular, that they're in a historical league all to themselves in terms of turnovers. Like it's really that bad.
It really places a cap on them. And I know you addressed this in the piece a little bit, but I'll say it now. You know, I think Tyler Jones, good friend of the program, said that a few times. Like, it's the reason that they can't be better than they are right now. Like, there are other reasons, too. Defense is certainly a problem for this team. But they could be better at the moment because they have a lot of offensive talent in certain ways. But when you turn the ball over at a historic rate, like it's not, we're not exaggerating here. They have a historically bad turnover rate. You just can't have success doing that.
Yeah. And I think I get into the historic aspects of it. Why the last 15 years is what we want to look at in terms of looking at turnover rate in particular, because of the changes in the rules in 2004. Just all of that stuff is sort of going to, you can read about that on Friday on Peachtree Hoops. I think that's what, that's the biggest thing for this Hawks team going forward. Obviously the defense is what it is. The defense is bad. It's not historically bad, like the turnover rate. And
it's been better recently, by the way. I think they're like number 19 over this run, which is not good, but it's not.
But it's fine. It's fine considering the personnel as well that they've been putting on the floor. The fact that Kent Bazemore hasn't played a lot of this run is also interesting. Like the fact that they run out Trae Young as the starting point guard every night and they're pretty competent defensively is kind of a miracle almost, you know, because, you know, they're in John Collins secretly is maybe not so secretly is really not that good on that end of the floor. And it's something that gets overlooked when you look at the fact that he's 20-10 every night. He gives up his 20-10 right back on the other end of the floor. And it's something that we've talked about in private. It's something that I'll probably write about at some point down the line, you know, in terms of his long-term future at the big man spots. I'm somebody who values defense at that spot, but I'm getting sort of far afield of what we're talking about here. The turnovers are really bad. The turnovers are something that are really holding them back. I get into why they turn the ball over so much, why the turnover rate might not be quite as bad as it looks on paper in terms of it being sort of historically bad over the last 15 years. There are reasons why they turn the ball over so much. The certain shots that they hunt in terms of corner threes and at the rim tend to come with larger turnover rates, but it is something that they're going to have to clean up if they want to be a good team at any point in the future, this year, next year, the year after. They're going to have to stop turning the ball over at some point.
Yeah, and that's the biggest reason right now that the defense is still better than the offense for the season is the turnovers, because they've shot the ball not incredibly well, but certainly reasonable. They have a good offensive rebound rate. You know, Collins has been instrumental in the rebounding on both ends of the floor. They've been actually like really good rebounding for a while, and that's almost all Collins because they were really bad without him, and now they're really good at it. So, you know, put the dots together there on that one. But yeah, it's all turnovers and defense, and defensively, the talent is what kind of holds them back. You know, for even if you disagree on certain player evaluations that we might have defensively, it's pretty clear that this team does not really have a single elite defender. Like maybe Bembry is in that category now or getting close to it. But, you know, Bazemore is certainly solid, I think is above average. But of all young guys at this moment, none of those guys are good defenders by any means. Even the guys who I think, you know, Kevin Herter has been encouraging, Collins has had some nice moments at times, but it's not, you know, your four-man core, your three-man core, especially your Herter, Young, Collins core, none of those guys are above average defensively by any means. And then you throw in the other guys around them. You know, Len can play defense, Debbie can play defense, but those guys are supporting pieces. So it's all about talent more than anything else. And then I think they're actually being coached pretty well defensively. But the turnovers, it's every player. It's not even one guy. I think a lot of that gets pinned on Trae Young, or gets pinned on even Bembry's had some really ugly games with the ball in his hands, obviously. But it's everybody. You look at up and down the roster. This is why I want you to read Jeff's piece. But up and down the roster, it's just it's easier to find. It's harder to find someone who's good at ball security than anything else, because it's really, really tough. Because there's just nobody there.
Yeah, and it's the guys who don't turn the ball over are the ones who shoot the ball every time. Except for Taurean Prince, who's somehow like a ball stopping shooter who doesn't pass very well and yet still turns the ball over like astronomically more than he should. And so it's he in particular, like, you know, Trey is going to turn the ball over. Jeremy Lin shouldn't turn the ball over as much as he does,
but
because
he does,
of
yeah.
How his offense, you know, gets going. He does turn the ball over. Because they're point guards, it's fine. I mean, it's not good, but it's fine. Especially Young, being as young as he is, it's fine. It's really the biggest one for me is Taurean Prince, because of, you know, he had a little bit more playmaking responsibilities early in the year, but he's just a turnover machine. And the fact
and
that Bem- he...
those Yeah, it's him and Bembry. Bembry is the one that makes everybody crazy. And I like Bembry. I won't speak for you. I've always been a big fan, but he just... with his offense the way it is, he just turns the ball over at a rate that's unsustainable. Like, you just can't have that guy on the court offensively. And I know he's great defensively. I know he does a lot of things well, but there are nights when I think he had a 6 turnover, no assist game over the weekend. And it felt like that. It wasn't like it was a fluke, like, oh, you look at the box score, like, oh, that happened, that was weird. No, it felt like he had that. Like, it was one of those games where he just, you know, again, and it's not, we're talking about individual players, it's everybody. There are only two or three guys on the whole roster that don't have a turnover problem. And that, you know, that's part of that is being young. Part of that is just having a bunch of guys to turn the ball over. But, you know, yeah, again, read Jeff's piece. I know we probably spoiled some of it just now, but it's worth diving into, I promise. And that'll be up on Friday morning. Jeff, please plug yourself before I let you get out of here. We've gone a full hour at this point, which is on brand for us. But please plug all of your other work that you'll be doing. Early Bird Rights is invaluable, which I will say, so you don't have to, but it's an awesome resource, especially this time of year when contracts are flying around. That's the first place. It's the best place. It's the fastest updating place. As soon as a transaction happens, unless Jeff's asleep and I have to call him and wake him up, every other time it's like 3 minutes and it's up. It's pretty crazy how good you are at doing that, so I'll say that so you don't have to.
Yeah, if you're interested in transactional stuff as the trade deadline approaches, as you want to know where teams are financially, Early Bird Rights is the best place for that on the internet. It's fastest. It's everything is automatically programmed in there. So I just update where guys are and everything just flows naturally. So that's how I can get it up so quickly. I don't have to do any mental math or I don't have to mess with anything on my end. I literally just open the thing and put a new guy in on his new team and that's the end of it. So it's real quick. It's real easy. It's everything is 100% accurate to my knowledge. Not everything is always 100% accurate, but I try to make it as 100% as I can. You can read all my stuff about the Hawks on Peachtree Hoops, the Cavs at Fear the Sword, the Portland Trailblazers at Blazers Edge, rest of the league for Forbes and for Dime. There are intermittent articles that go up on Early Bird Rights every once in a while. That's more of an off-season thing for me as well. So we'll gear up toward that as we get into, you know, June and July. But for now, it's Early Bird Rights is all about the salary cap stuff with the trades and such. So lots of stuff going on, lots of fun cap stuff going into the trade deadline. And of course, we'll have all coverage of the team on Peachtree Hoops and coverage of the rest of the league elsewhere.
Yeah, please follow Jeff on Twitter at JG Siegel. Get all of his content. Follow him in all those places. Bookmark Early Bird Rights. It's a very, very important resource that I use, I think, every day at this point. So shouts to Jeff on that. As for everybody else listening to the podcast, please subscribe to the show. If you are a new listener, please, I guess, welcome aboard, number one. But number two, please subscribe via the platform of your choice, whether it be Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, Overcast, all those places. There's definitely a place for you, I promise. And if we're not at a platform that you're already using, please let me know that and we'll get that rectified in a hurry. So subscribe to the pod. We'll be back again later in the week. And if nothing else, tell your friends. Thanks to Jeff, and we'll see you guys later on in the week.